So I think this is going to be a shorter set of comments than usual. I want to say basic things about Plato's Allegory of the Cave, probably the most famous passage in Western philosophy. And I want to link it together with people who you might think of as like antagonists of Plato, Paulo Freire, bell hooks, and a little bit Alicia Garza. But I don't think they actually are in this respect. Politically, they certainly would be. But the model of education, which is one of the ways that you can read the Allegory of the Cave, that's probably the most direct thing that Socrates says in the Republic. This is about education, he says. The model of education that is given here is pretty consistent with what Freire, Garza, and Hooks are all talking about too. So I'll just try and lay out a few different readings pretty quickly, a few different readings of the cave, and then I'll say how this relates to these other thoughts about education. But let me start off just by talking about education. Why in our class is it reasonable to pause and talk explicitly about education for a moment? Remember that in Aristotle's Politics, at one point he used the phrase, I think it's in the passages that we read, the phrase, a society of education or an educational society. And I think what he meant, he's talking about the polity, the polis. I think what he meant was that the unity of this society was to be produced and reproduced across time through education. This is something worth recognizing. All societies do education. They train the young. They give them language. They give them habits. They give them morals. They give them truths. They give them notions of common sense. They give them ideas about the proper and the improper types of relations. They educate them. And in fact, only by educating the young is it possible to sustain the society in its given form, which is all that unifies a society or defines a society across time. It's only possible to sustain that form across time by retraining each generation. No society can do without education. And this means also that dominating societies, societies that take women or underclasses and put them in positions of subjugation, they also operate by education. Now, I think if we get a little bit more into this, we'll be able to say, well, maybe we should call this instead indoctrination. And that's probably correct. What is given to most people in dominator societies, which are most of our societies, although there are these pockets of non-domination or less domination, community and democracy throughout these societies, as Uchelon told us at the beginning of the class, mostly in dominator societies, top-down and hierarchical societies, the educational system doesn't actually function to do education. In a lot of ways, it functions to do the opposite of education, to produce illusion, which is one of the readings, the unavoidable readings, I think, of the Allegory of the Cave. Education in Plato is to be reserved for the few, for the guardians, and ultimately for the philosopher kings. They're the only ones who can really do education in its highest sense. Everybody else is going to be subjected to a regime of images which are meant to delude them in useful ways. Remember, Plato already told us, or Socrates already told us, that a good ruler has to use falsehood like a drug. And they're authorized to do so because supposedly they know what's good for the city, and that's why it's okay for them to tell stories like the myth of the metals, or to lie about how the eugenics program for the guardians is going to work. Like, this is legitimized because they know and everybody else doesn't. So everybody else, the majority, in Plato's Republic or in our society, are subject to a regime of representation which has a use value, which has a function, which is to sustain the society in its present form, in the form of domination. Most people don't get to know. Most people don't get to free their minds. Most people don't get to move towards liberation, because that would screw up the whole society. If the society is not liberated, if the society rests upon the labor and exploitation of the vast majority for the few, you can't educate the majority. But there is something that is called education. Let's call it schooling. Schooling is what sets up this notion of common sense. Alicia Garza mentions Antonio Gramsci, who uses the term hegemony, the production of consent, the manufacture of consent, and the production of a sense of common sense in the general populace. This is what the schools are for. And put that together with the schools also operate to facilitate continued production. So there is real knowledge, if you want to call it that, in schooling. You know, you can learn how to program at college, for sure. You can learn advanced mathematics in college, for sure. But generally speaking, you're not going to learn how to think. You're not going to learn the fundamentally defiant and liberatory and anti-authoritarian tendencies of your own mind. In fact, they'll tell you that there is no such thing. Okay, so I guess the distinction that we could make is that, you know, Plato and these other figures, Hooks, Garza, and Frege, they're opposed politically. Plato is an arch conservative. He thinks that most people are not fit to liberate themselves, to think, to understand, definitely to rule. Most people are dominated by their bodies, dominated by their love of pleasure, and they're totally happy to be swept up in illusion and not think about much of anything. These other figures are not satisfied with that arrangement. They instead want to think about the education, the organization, the activation of the majority in order to transform a society of domination such that it becomes something more appropriate to free and dignified beings like we really are. That all said, the model of education, what education is, the turning of the soul is one quick way to abbreviate that in Plato. That notion of education, it's pretty much the same thing in Plato and in these other writers, which is pretty remarkable. You know, 2,400 years later, when Frege is trying to figure out how do you do education as a part of a revolutionary project, he still says the same things that Plato, the arch justifier of domination, said 2,400 years previously. So maybe he's onto something, right? Okay, so let's go to the allegory of the cave. In Plato's Republic, beginning of book 7, there's this story that most people have heard of, and you get in the majority of intro to philosophy classes, and it goes like this. It's like, imagine a bunch of enslaved people who have been enslaved and tied up in chains since they were born. They're attached to these posts at the bottom of a deep, dark cave, and they have never been anywhere else, and they can only see the wall in front of them. On this wall, they see shadows move, and they hear echoes, but they don't know that they're echoes. They hear voices. And because they have never seen anything else, these shadows, which of course the meaning of a shadow is that it has to be produced by other causes, right? By the interaction of an object and a light source. They don't know that that's what's going on. They think, because they've never seen anything else, that the shadows are reality. And because they don't know that there is another source of the voices somewhere behind them, they don't know that the voices are echoes. They think that the voices go along with the shadows. And then they have these hierarchies of foolishness, where they'll respect the people who can predict which shadow is going to come next. You know, they believe that that's the world. That's reality. Okay, so let's just pause right there for a moment. Of course, there's stuff going on in the background, or maybe I should lay that out. The stuff in the background is there's a path that goes up behind these prisoners, and along the wall between the path, between the path and the prisoners, there is a low wall, kind of shielding the path as it heads up. Behind the path, there's a fire. And way up above all that, the path winds towards an opening. You can't see it from below, but if you follow it up, It'll take you out into the world. And out there are real things, right? But there are people moving along this path, and they are carrying effigies. They are carrying puppets, which represent the things that are really out in the world. Little bunny rabbits and towers and, I don't know, horses and people. They're representing them. And then the fire passing by these objects casts the shadows. So these people are responsible for the production of the shadows. It's a process of the projection of light from the fire. It's blockage by the representations, which results in the thing on the wall. But the people looking at the wall don't know that this process, this causal process, which results in the appearances that they perceive, they don't know that it's there. Okay, so let's give three readings of this. I'm going to call reading number one metaphysical. Metaphysical, you know, you will recognize that from the bookstore, I suppose, or from, you know, the Amazon books section or whatever. We take that to mean, you know, bearing on first principles, having to do with the ultimate foundations of who we are and what the world is. That's metaphysical. It's kind of an arbitrary term, actually. It comes from Aristotle. A lot of the writing that we have from Aristotle is actually notes for lectures, either written by Aristotle himself or by students who heard these lectures. And there's a section that is about first principles, you know, the most ultimately real things, the principles that explain everything else. And the book that discusses these things happened to be arranged when somebody found this stuff after the physics, right? So physis is nature, or the inherent force of nature. Metaphysis is just, it's meta means next. So it's the book after the physics. So there's not a super deep meaning here, but the denotation is metaphysics refers to how things really are, and perhaps all of Western metaphysics has some relationship to the difference between appearance and reality. Metaphysics is the attempt to discover reality behind appearances, which, by the way, is still what our science does, right? You want to explain something falling to the ground, you know, the beginning of a rationalistic scientific explanation would be to say, well, there's a force called gravity, which operates between massive bodies, and the bigger mass will pull the smaller mass towards it. Notice that we're saying this is what's really happening when you like drop your pen, but you only see the pen fall. You can never see gravity. And yet we, as a culture, still believe that gravity is the real thing in the background, which explains the thing that we can perceive, namely the pen falling. We also believe that appearance is insufficient, and that reality is something that has to be sought beyond appearance, and even that reality being, you know, rules that don't change. This is what science wants. This is what philosophy wants. This is a part of the invisible domain. You know, knowledge and what is ultimately real is distinct from what is seen. Okay, so if we read the allegory of the cave as an allegory about metaphysics, it's talking about sensation. So we're the prisoners, and we're looking at the wall, and we're believing in things which are actually caused by causes that are hidden from us. And this is the condition of most people in the world. They believe what they sense, and they believe that what they sense is simply reality. So everything I can see right now, everything I can hear right now, everything I can feel right now as I sit here in my chair and look out my door, this is what we tend to believe in as reality. And yet the claim is, just as I suggested, that there are things beyond these appearances that I can receive. And it is those things beyond the appearances that I am immediately aware of, which explains them, which causes them, which is realer than them, right? Like, why do I see the pine tree that I'm looking at? Well, because there's like light bouncing off some kind of physical structure over there, and it's hitting my eye, and the back of my eye at the retina is responding to certain frequencies, but not all of them, certain frequencies, which are then being processed by supposedly my occipital cortex. And then I'm having the experience of seeing this thing. Seeing this thing is not just an immediate relationship with reality. It's a mediated relationship with reality. And in fact, the reality, the physical world, that physical tree, which always exceeds what I can see of it. you know, just to begin with, because I can't see all the sides. But beyond that, because I can't see all the colors, I can't see all the frequencies, I can't see all the motion, my temporal frame is limited in all this. Reality exceeds my perception. And if I'm being a good scientific and philosophical person, I'm going to seek out the causes, the reality that is behind what we perceive. That's the metaphysical interpretation. It goes along with Plato and Socrates' profound distrust of momentary existence, bodily perception, and bodily pleasures, too. Going along with this, if we're stuck on those shadows, part of this is that we're also stuck in our body. And so the idea is that a well-formed individual, one who's going to be capable of philosophy, which is the highest activity we can do, is going to have to turn away from that which is immediately sensed, and towards something which is realer and less variant and invisible and accessible only to the mind, and especially to be accessed through philosophical discussion. We can be friends to one another by helping one another to understand the real forces, the real structures, which determine what it is that we immediately experience. This is the metaphysical interpretation. Now, there's also a political interpretation, which I think people overlook a lot. You know, like back when I used to teach this stuff, I used to always get papers where people would tell me, Plato's saying that we all need to be saved from the cave. We all need to be brought into the light. But he's not saying that. People assume that because we have inherited some kind of universalistic, humanistic set of common sense pronouncements. But Plato isn't saying that at all. He's saying, really, that only a few people can actually make the voyage out of the cave. Most people don't want to. And if you go back into that cave and you start telling these people about the realities that you have now understood cause the shadows that they believe are all there is to the world, they'll kill you. Right? This is the big difference, I think, between Plato and these progressive or even revolutionary folks that we have set opposite Plato, is that Plato really thinks most people aren't capable of education. So what's really going on there? You have to focus on the people who are carrying these effigies, these puppets. Where do they come from? They come from the world outside, I suppose. The models that they're carrying are representations of the outside world. Who's outside? The philosopher kings are. Who sends down the people with the puppets? We're not told, but I'm thinking it's the rulers. One way or the other, the people who are carrying those puppets are responsible for producing the illusions that the people down at the bottom of the cave perceive and believe. So when Socrates says, or when in Book 7 we get the general picture of education of the guardians, and he says they're going to have 15 years of practical political training, this can be thought of as going back into the cave and not telling people that what they believe in is false, but rather modulating the falsehoods by which they are organized. This is political control. The allegory can be read, should be read, secondly, as an allegory. An allegory is like a story where you have several symbols, the fire, the puppets, the shadows, the echoes, the sun, the outside world. You have these elements, and they each stand for something else. So in the metaphysical interpretation, the shadows stand for sense perception. In the political interpretation of the allegory, the shadows stand for propaganda, or ideology, or hegemony in Garza and Gramsci's language. There is someone who is programming the images that the general population sees. And I think part of the picture here is that this may be necessary. This is how it is. Most people are just going to stay there, attached to their posts. What does it mean to be attached to the post in this allegory? Stuck in your body, driven by your body, driven by your desires, by your pleasures and your pains, and then seduced, hypnotized by your sensations. Most people are just like that. Most people are never going to leave there. And so the best thing you can do for them is to lie to them in a way that they will never know, but we can say, we, these philosopher kings or something, is wise. Because we know what's good for them. we're going to deceive them. We're going to tell them if they work hard, they're going to succeed. We're going to tell them that, well, you know, black folks and Mexicans down at the bottom of the heap because of, you know, the backwardsness of their cultures. You know, this is kind of like the myth of the metals. That's I always hear race when I read the myth of the metals. So these are falsehoods, and Plato has already identified them as falsehoods. But they are noble falsehoods on his account, because it is necessary to organize these fools who want nothing but to roll around in the dirt with animals, to be swept up in this perpetual chaos and confusion of becoming, a world that never holds still. Only a few people have a love of the truth that is strong enough to overcome their love of pleasure, and they alone are the ones who could become guardians and philosopher kings. Okay, and then lastly, this should be read as an allegory of education. It tells you what education is. What's education? It's turning the soul. It's reorienting yourself so that you are no longer fundamentally and perpetually fixated on that which is immediately given, on what everybody says is true, on the common sense that we have inherited, on the things that they always say on TV, on the shadows, on the wall. We are no longer satisfied with that, or, you know, with sense perception. Can't just be enough to say, I see certain things. I want to know what leads to that seeing. I want to know what are those things behind the perspective I have upon them. This is an educated attitude. If I am the person who seeks out causes, I am not satisfied with that which is given, but I always seek out causes, I am at least becoming educated, or I am educated. So what is the educational move? You look for the cause. You look away from that which is given. You distrust that which is presented to us. You suspect that perhaps there's more to the story, or even that we are being deceived. You don't trust just what is said, what is presented. You look behind it. That is the mark of an educated person. We read this last semester, you know. Angela Davis says almost exactly the same thing. This insistence on questioning is the mark of an educated person, she said. That was in 1968 when she got fired from UCLA. Okay, so this is how I would read this stuff. Now, I want to add in a few more things about the details throughout the chapter that have to do with education. One, for those who are going to be educated, the guardians, the people who might have the capacity for philosophy, we want to draw their attention to something that Socrates calls summoners. Summoners are sensual perceptions, sensory perceptions, things that we can see, which nevertheless are somehow insufficient or troubling or contradictory. And he gives at least two examples. One of them is relative terms. Like if you look at someone and you say, oh, that's a small person, well, you're perceiving smallness. And yet if you think about smallness, there is no such thing as smallness in the world all by itself. Smallness implies a comparison, right? Small compared to what? So what is given in the immediate sensation and what is comprehended are somehow insufficient. They point beyond themselves. This awakens thought. If we look at those perceptions that we have, which are really relative perceptions, fast, slow, we can start to see that actually, well, what's given in our perception, what's immediately apparent, is not complete in itself, but it has some kind of like structural relationship to other things. And then he says also, we're going to teach mathematics from a pretty early age to our guardians, to the people who get to get educated. And one of the primary reasons for this is that the units of mathematics are nowhere to be found in experience. Or like a unit, a perfect unity, doesn't exist in the world. By which I mean anything that is one in the world is also many. It brings with it its opposite, and this produces thought. If we start to recognize that things aren't just what they seem to be, but something else besides, or maybe also their opposite, such that there is a contradiction, this troubles the mind, and the troubled mind is an active mind. The mind should be troubled. Thought begins with trouble. Thought passes through pretty much nothing but trouble. An active thinking being is one who is troubled, not one who is sedate, not one who is sure of themselves, and without doubt. That's the absence of thought. And then let's look at the overall pattern of education. It's supposed to be, remember, way at the beginning when we have these guardians as children, they're going to be taught music and poetry, rhythm. It's very important what kind of models they adopt, what kinds of activities they come to find normal and healthy and pleasant. And then there's going to be physical training. Got to make their bodies strong. There's going to be military service. We want to make them disciplined and courageous. And then we're going to do this mathematics training for like 10 years. And only after all of this stuff will they get to do what I would consider to be like the heart of philosophy and the heart of thought and philosophical thinking as it is presented in the Republic. And that is called dialectic. So we can talk about dialectic in two ways, and we probably should do both. One is the way that it's presented here in the Republic. And note that dialectic is something that is to be taught only to the promising guardians, only to the ones who might be capable of being philosopher kings. And these will only be the ones who have proven themselves in battle, the people who have proven that they can hold on to the beliefs that they're given, even through profound pain and pleasure and threat. Only the good believers, only the ones who were ready to accept what was told them by the authorities, are going to be allowed to learn this art of dialectic, because if lawless people use it, it's going to wreck everything. And every time, you know, Plato tells me, well, if such and such happens, it's going to wreck everything, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Maybe we should look at that in case we want to wreck everything. So dialectic in here in the Republic is a process of thought which, instead of starting off with various what he calls hypotheses, formulas, maxims, affirmations, propositions that we believe, you know, so if you're working, you know, you're going to learn to be an engineer and you're going to make bridges, you're going to have to internalize a certain set of formulas and basic mathematical relationships. Because you're going to be this practical worker, your job is not to inquire further about those formulas, but simply to know them and to be able to implement them. That's one variety of thought, but it's not the highest variety of thought. The highest variety of thought, instead of starting with hypotheses and working downward into the world, dialectic moves backwards. It tries to identify the assumptions upon which we are operating and to turn those into questions. When I said, you know, for me, freedom of thought or philosophy has a fundamentally defiant, anti-authoritarian aspect to it, that maybe we should destroy all authority in thought. This is what I meant. That we can do dialectic, meaning we can identify the assumptions which are guiding our understanding and our action, and we can turn them into questions. you could go on. You know, dialectic is probably more familiar to us from Hegel and Marx. And it, you know, it's part of the same lineage. But there's a bit of different thinking in Hegel and Marx. They're thinking about large-scale totalities, big, complex structures, which are organized internally out of different parts pointing in different directions, where there's a whole lot of contradiction, which we've talked about, like the contradiction between the classes, but also like the contradictions between dominant ideologies and lived realities, right? There are contradictions. These contradictions can be summoners. The job of someone doing political education is to draw the attention of people who live in a certain situation to the contradictions inherent within that situation, some of which are veiled over, like the difference between the interests of the workers and the bosses, and some of which exist between the veiling and the reality. You know, there's a contradiction between the idea that, you know, in this country, everybody has opportunity. In this country, everybody can be happy. And the fact that actually opportunity is very differentially distributed, not everybody has the same opportunity. And arguably, most of us are not happy. You know, no society has ever like swallowed as many pills as we do. Why is that? So political education has to point at at contradictions in order to awaken thought so that we can understand the larger structure that we're a part of. So dialectical thinking in this sense always indicates, always signifies, starting with like a moment or a moment of contradiction in order to move from the locality to the whole, towards the whole. We want to move from the situation that we are a part of, seek out its causes in order to become familiar with the real structures which are setting up the situation in which we now find ourselves. So dialectic and liberation go together here for 2,200-2,300 years. Last thing from Plato, the last thing that a philosopher king is going to learn, you know, they have metaphorically moved from the prison. They're liberating themselves from the senses. They're liberating themselves from immediacy. They're becoming familiar with the invisible domain of thought. They're becoming sharper and clearer and more careful about their reasonings. They're probably talking together with other people of their class. And metaphorically, allegorically, they're moving up the path, finally out the door into the real world. And there they sit under their tree, seeing the real animals and the beautiful colors. And last of all, they look up and they're like, wow, all of this is from the sun. The sun is that which gives the condition of the visibility of all things. It sets up light. Light is the condition of the possibility of the coming together of knower and known, of sensor and sensed. And it's also the force which causes everything to grow. Allegorically, the sun becomes the good, or the good beyond being, to say it more precisely, as it's laid out in the Republic. And historically, as this Platonic doctrine is picked up, this becomes God. So the idea is that the philosopher king, after this long journey of passing through, learning how to do dialectic, doing 15 years of political training, finally they're going to be in a position to start asking questions about the good. And the idea, remember, is that these rulers deserve to rule because they alone know what is good. And I always wondered, well, it's a secret. Like in the Republic, Socrates is pushed on a couple of different occasions to say more about the good. What is this good beyond being, which is the condition of possibility of all the eidos, of the forms, the invariant eternal truths, like the law of gravity, for example, that we can know it's caused by, well, by God, right? And it's the knowledge of God, which ultimately, or the, they don't say God, the knowledge of the good beyond being, which ultimately justifies the rule of the philosopher king, which this is what the wisdom of the philosopher king consists in. And but it's a secret, and you don't get to know what is the good, what is the character of good, what is the character of the highest principle, which causes everything else, until you've proven yourself, until, you know, you're 30, 40 years into your so-called education. And I always wondered if, like, well, so the good's a secret. What if the secret is that there is no good? What if the secret is that there's only power? And then you have those in power deceiving those who are not in power and cultivating just a select few to become the next people who are in power. You know, the Sith Lord picks a young Sith apprentice. Okay, so let me just put this back in contact. I think it should be clear already how this is in contact with Frege and Hooks and Garza. They have a difference with Plato in that they're not willing to believe that the majority of people are incapable of coming into contact with reality, that they are all just so foolish, that they are so immature, that they are so dominated by their bodies that their minds can never be liberated. They don't accept this position. But what they're trying to do, they want everybody to get educated, right? And the organization, you know, even for Black Lives Matter, the organization of the masses, the building of a base, in large measure consists in political education work. So what is this that we have to do in Frege or in Garza? It's the same thing again. It's just that we're doing education from the bottom up here, instead of from the top down. Like we're avoiding schooling. You know, radical pedagogy, which is what we call Frege's system, is a critique of schooling. It's a critique of top down indoctrinating, domination style so-called education, which is not really education, because instead of waking the mind up, so, you know, Plato says that those who turn the soul are the only ones who are awake. Everybody else who stares there and believes all the shit they say on Fox News are asleep. They are dreaming. In this case, we're saying, well, everybody should wake up. Everybody could wake up. Everybody should wake up. And this is the work that we need to do in our communities. We need to, just like Plato said, Frege says, Garza says, let's turn everything into questions. And specifically, let's try to ask questions which lead us to evaluate, delineate, really, the situations where we really are. And by delineating these situations, by pointing out the contradictions, by waking up the minds, so that instead of just repeating the common sense that we have been given by means of the shadows on the wall, that is, television, movies, the news, school, bunch of bullshit that the leaders gave us to keep us down in the hole, instead of taking those things for granted, instead of accepting without question the hypotheses that are offered to us, we should instead take these hypotheses, we have to be dialectical, and turn them into questions, and look for what's the explanation of that hypothesis, that thing that we always say, where does that come from? Is it true? Let's compare it to the situation in which we really find ourselves. And Frege thinks, just like Plato thinks, that we can really only do this education thing through discussion. And Aristotle thought, you know, this is friends. That's the best thing you can have in the world as far as interhuman relationships. And one of the fundamental reasons they're so important is that only with friends can we speak honestly so as to get past our own confusions, to really identify our own assumptions, to recognize our own contradictions and the contradictions between what we're told and what is, and the contradictions between the interests of people in our world. Only by talking together honestly, in a trusting way, with no bullshit, is it really possible to arrive at a good understanding, a true understanding of the reality behind our appearances. That is, but here we're not talking about some eternal domain that is outside the world of becoming. We're just talking about the situation, the real world we're really in, which is very difficult to ascertain, very difficult to perceive, because we are systematically given the means of being deceived, because we've been lied to, because all the assumptions about what's normal, what's common sense, are put there to prevent us acting upon these structures which structure us. So we got to go through a process of recognizing the contradictions, being woken up by the things that like don't feel right, the contradictions, the thing that is also its opposite, the thing that feels true but it's also clearly bullshit. These things should bother us. We have to talk together as groups, but these groups have to have trust or else we can't speak honestly. And this also requires, at a deep level, praxis, which we talked about so much last semester. Praxis, meaning I can only have this honest conversation with you and what the world is really like and what the school is really like if the critique that I'm offering is followed by actions which follow from that critique. If I sit there and tell you all about how school is domination and then I dominate you, well, I'm in bad faith. I'm full of shit. I'm engaged in idle chatter. And the consequence is that I have just destroyed the conditions of possibility of the education and liberation of the people who are with me. And it doesn't just have to be a teacher who could do this, right? Like whenever the shit that we say doesn't match up with the shit that we do, we have lost our integrity and we have become incapable of real dialogue, which is the only means, this is a social means, a horizontal social means by which we can arrive at a good understanding of where we're at with the intention of actually changing that situation.